You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM, all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and 200 cable systems nationwide. Welcome to our program. Interesting stuff on this whole personhood. Can a town, can a community control its own fate? And I saw this news story this morning and I thought, bingo, I want to talk with Thomas Lindsay about this. He's the smartest guy I know on the issue, and he's been in the center of the cyclone for well over a decade, the attorney and executive director, co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And you want to write this down because CELDEF is doing work that might be of value in your community too. In fact, will be, I guarantee you, someday, if not tomorrow. CELDF.org is their website. And Thomas, welcome back to the program.
Yes, thanks for having us back on, Tom.
The story that I saw was that a New York State judge ruled on Tuesday, from I think it's the New York Times, that the upstate town of Dryden in Tompkins County can ban natural gas drilling within its boundaries. Now, you have been, correct me if I'm wrong, you have been helping communities say to corporations, sorry, you simply don't have the right to do this in our town because we don't recognize your rights as a person. And what this town did was they said, we're not going to debate the personhood issue of this. We're simply going to make it a zoning issue. And the court has upheld the right of a town to have zoning regulations. Do I have that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I think what we're seeing with the town of Dryden, which is in the Finger Lakes region over near Ithaca, New York, and those folks have moved forward to pass a zoning ordinance within their municipality that bans fracking within all of the zones within the municipality. And New York is lucky, and Dryden's lucky in many ways, as towns in New York are, in that the New York Constitution recognizes a degree of home rule for those municipalities. And so generally, if you're in a place like Pennsylvania, for example, and you move forward with a ban on fracking or other corporate activities within your municipality, you're generally going to get sued with three different challenges by the corporations. One is that you've violated preemption, because most of these states have oil and gas laws in place, which specifically restrict municipalities from being able to regulate oil and gas operations. The second one is something called Dillon's Rule, which says that states are the parent, municipalities are the children, and the children only have the powers that the state chooses to give to them. And the final piece is corporate personhood or corporate rights, which generally allow the corporations, in this case the gas corporations, to sue the municipality for damages. Right. And what happened in Dryden was they've managed to get through the first two doctrines of those three that corporations usually use to keep municipalities subordinate. And on that, the third one, however, which is the corporation that sued the town of Dryden, is now saying, well, although the court has ruled that the town is not preempted from passing this ordinance banning fracking, we, however, are thinking about bringing a corporate rights suit against the town for damages incurred as a result of us not being able to drill within the town of Dryden.
And we being the oil companies, the gas.
We meaning the gas companies. And the gas company is saying that they've expended up to $5 million in attempting to exploit gas reserves there. And because the corporation has constitutional rights, it may give rise to a lawsuit by the corporation against the town now for the value of the gas assets that it can't extract due to the zoning ordinance that was passed.
So not only could they get back their $5 million, but they could say, hey, there's $1 billion worth of gas into this town. We want $1 billion if you're not going to give us the gas.
Yes, and that all happens through the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment, which says the property can't be taken by a government without compensation. And right. So a corporation as a person has those Fifth Amendment takings protections,
that
opens the door for that lawsuit. But there's an even bigger problem, which is we think that the decision that came out, it's a really good victory, and we congratulate the folks and have congratulated the folks who are working on it. We think it may be a brief reprieve in that it generally happens that when these types of puncture points open up in the corporate fabric, that the system reacts pretty quickly, and that reaction is either going to take place by an appellate court. You know, if the corporation appeals, it goes up to the higher levels, and the appellate court overrules the lower court, or second, that the legislature will intervene. And in New York, it's not unusual for the legislature to intervene. In fact, New York pioneered a model about a decade ago in which the state now routinely nullifies municipal ordinances that deal with corporate farming operations. And so we're looking for those over the next couple months or so. But suffice it to say that New York is a stronger home rule state than most. In other words, municipalities have more room to roam. If you're in Pennsylvania and some of these other places, you may not have those tools to use.
When Louise and I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, one of the really interesting things about living there, and I don't know the status of this now, but perhaps you do, but Montpelier is the smallest capital in the United States. It's like 7,900 people or 9,700 people, and also the only one without a McDonald's. And every other year at the town hall meeting or at the town meeting, we would vote to tax ourselves another, my recollection is $47,000, to pay the legal fees for the local law firm that fought McDonald's every year.
Right.
And the way that we did it was we said, if you're going to have a restaurant inside the city of Montpelier, you have to bake your own bread and have table service. In other words, we did it by zoning and by defining what a restaurant was. And so we ended up with a Dunkin' Donuts and a Subway, and they both offered table service. The Dunkin' Donuts eventually went out of business. And the Subway is a locally owned franchise. But there was never a McDonald's or Burger King or any of that other stuff. And it worked for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the sort of thing, was that unique to Vermont? Has that been blown up since, you know, we've left? It's been about 6 years since I've lived in Vermont. Or is that the kind of thing that can be done? What are the options, really, that communities are looking at if they're trying to keep these predatory corporations out?
Well, we don't think that zoning ordinances are an option, because generally zoning ordinances only allow you to separate out incompatible land uses, so residential from commercial from industrial. And the courts have been pretty well settled in one area, which is that if you attempt to use the zoning ordinance to ban a legal use in the community, that violates the corporation's constitutional rights under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. And that's pretty much been across the board in the states. The only reason why communities have been able to use the zoning ordinance and land use process the way that you describe is because the corporation doesn't want to come in there badly enough. And that may sound funny to say, but the zoning ordinance and land use provisions that have been used across the United States to make it more difficult for Walmart to come in, for example, where there are square footage limitations imposed on a Walmart coming into a community. If Walmart wanted to in those situations and wanted to come into the community badly enough, they can use the Interstate Commerce Clause, which gives corporations certain powers to override local ordinances or decision makings that govern commerce issues.
Right.
Or they could use constitutional rights to override. And so we have this myth in the United States, I think, in many ways, about local self-government. And we exercise it a lot, and it's not curtailed in a lot of situations, only because the corporations don't want to come in badly enough.
Thomas, just very quickly, we just have about 30 seconds left. If a constitutional amendment was passed that said corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech, would that resolve this problem?
No, because you need a frontal assault on the three different doctrines that keep us subordinate to the corporate boys. And those are, number one, preemption, number two, Dillon's rule, this concept of our communities don't have any rights except those recognized by the state, and the state's being used by the corporation to get what they want. And third is this corporate rights piece.
Do we do it by constitutional amendment?
I think you do it by constitutional change. The question becomes, how do you get the battery power to actually do that? And I think that only comes with 10,000 communities standing up and saying, we're not going to do this anymore.
Absolutely.
And then changing their state constitution, which eventually forces changes to the federal constitution.
Right. What you refer to as collective nonviolent municipal civil disobedience through lawmaking.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah, but it's absolutely brilliant. And you're doing a great job with it, Thomas. And I encourage everybody to get over to CELDEF, CELDF, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org. And check it out. Thomas Lindsay, thanks again for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us back.
Great talking with you, as always. We will be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So we've got one more thing we have to add to our constitutional amendment. Corporations are just subordinate to everything, right? Just put them down there with pond scum.
Because I heard you.
Come on.
I heard you say that I agree. So you were starting something, you gotta keep it up now. Forward!
Okay.
Come on.
In case you missed it, that is your President of the United States, Barack Obama. They had a big blues festival at the White House last night. This is the thing that Victoria Jones was telling us Mick Jagger was going to be showing up for. What a hoot. Okay, the word capitalist. We still don't have a clear definition of when the term capitalist came into popular use. Capital, meaning ownership of things, goes back to the 12th and 13th century. This is relying on the Wikipedia, and the Wikipedia, when it comes to things like capitalism and the Great Depression and other things, has been so heavily edited by right-wingers that I consider it a highly unreliable source for any information that where a right-winger might have something to say. So we'll still keep an eye out for that. So a lot going on. January, particularly, the numbers are in. The numbers are in. January was a spectacular month for super PACs. While the candidates, this is on the Republican side, while the candidates, Romney, Santorum, Gingrich, and Paul, raised $21 million in January, their super PACs raised $22 million. Isn't that sweet? The billionaires are raising more money than the candidates. And there's a piece in today's Washington Post that showed, you know, who the billionaires were and which candidate they owned. And I don't understand how anyone in America looking at this thing can say, you know, we still have a free enterprise system in the United States. We still that back to the capitalist argument. And we still have a small d democracy in America. This is plutocracy. A plutocracy is a government run by plutocrats, by the very, very wealthy. Decisions made by the plutocrats, the very, very wealthy. How is it that Mitt Romney pays 15% income tax, 14.9% income tax? It's because the plutocrats got laws passed that benefit them. How is it that General Electric filed a 19-foot-high Internal Revenue Service income tax form? 19 feet high. You print the thing out. It was 19 and a half feet high. And as a consequence of that, they paid no taxes because they're plutocrats. And they were able to buy enough legislators and enough legislation to get enough holes drilled in the tax code so that they didn't have to pay any income taxes. Now, the president has come out and said, you know, we're going to take the United States has a top corporate tax rate of 35%. Most of the OECD countries have a 25% or a 28% or a 30% top rate. We are among the developed countries. Actually, we have the highest corporate income tax rate. Now, that's not the total tax the corporations are paying. In most of the OECD countries, corporations are paying a lot more in taxes because they have VAT taxes, value-added taxes. So every stage along the way of manufacturing a product or improving the quality of a product or improving the value of a product, the company has to pay a tax. But the right-wingers never talk about that in America. Instead, they just say, we've got the highest corporate taxes in the world. And so Obama is going to pull a John Kennedy. You'll recall back in the day, back in 1960, John Kennedy, when he was debating Richard Nixon, he said, I want to drop the top tax rate for rich people, millionaires like himself, like Jack Kennedy, from 91% down to 74% and close up enough loopholes that we're actually collecting more money and we're going to use that money to spend more money in our administration. Here's Jack Kennedy telling how he's going
to
do it.
I think it's possible to gain $700 million to $1 billion
more money
in tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes. On dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
Oh, on dividend withholding. Yeah, he wants to go after Mitt Romney. And here's how he's going to spend that money.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration
more.
On aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Now, the right-wingers run around and go, oh, Jack Kennedy, he cut taxes. No, he lowered the tax rate, but he actually raised taxes on rich people. They ended up paying more money because he got rid of a bunch of loopholes. And it wasn't actually Kennedy who did it. It was Lyndon Johnson. It happened in 64, the year after Kennedy died. But it was Kennedy who proposed it, Kennedy who put it forward. And you just heard him in his own words saying that. And now Barack Obama is saying the same thing. He's saying, let's drop the top tax rate from 35 down to 28%, and let's close up the loopholes. And in fact, let's even have a 25% top tax rate for companies that manufacture in the United States. If you want to manufacture outside the United States, 28%. And one of the loopholes that he wants to close is the ability to manufacture offshore and not pay taxes. And I say, God bless him. I am totally in favor of this. This is John Kennedy jujitsu that the president of the United States is performing, and he's doing it. And how can the right wingers say anything about it? You know, they're going to have to be sputtering. I mean, it's so brilliant how this guy can take the right wingers and just flip them over his shoulder using their own language. You want to cut taxes? Fine, I'll cut taxes. It's exactly the way Jack Kennedy did it. And Jack Kennedy, and nowadays, those of you who are longtime listeners of this program know that in the 9 years that we've been on the air, at least 100 different conservatives have come on this program and tried to feed me this line that they all, I think, believe because they don't know history. Oh, you know, Jack Kennedy lowered the top income tax rate on rich Americans, and it led to increased revenues for the federal government. And as you just heard, well, yeah, he lowered the top tax rate, but he increased the amount of taxes that were collected by closing loopholes. He actually raised taxes on rich people. And Barack Obama is going to, this is going to be revenue neutral. He's not going to overall raise taxes on corporations, but he's going to make them smarter. He's going to stop giving them tax benefits for moving things offshore. I think it's just great. So, anyhow, we'll see how this plays, given the fact that 30 of the Fortune 500 companies spend more money on lobbying than on taxes. Might be tough.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
A lot coming up in our show today. Eric Zimmerman is going to be with us in our second hour. And in our third hour, we're going to Kristen Day is going to be talking with Executive Director of Democrats for Life.
Roll down the windows with the radio loud. Come on, turn it up.
Slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. You know how we caught you doing something right alert. You know how usually people like to complain and they like to catch people doing things wrong, and it's like the worst management style in the world. You know, the boss is constantly, you're constantly afraid they're going to poke you with a stick. I'm a fan of praising people when they do things right and generally ignoring when they do things wrong unless it's really egregious. And here's, so I want to congratulate, this fellow for doing something right. His name is Antonio Darden in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he runs Antonio's Hair Studio. And here's a pretty self-explanatory clip. Keep in mind, New Mexico has a Republican governor who is a woman, Susana Martinez, and, she is vehemently opposed to gay marriage. So here's a clip from Channel 4 KOB in Santa Fe that is self-explanatory.
The governor's aides called not too long ago wanting another appointment to come in. Because of her stances and her views on this, I told her aides no. They called the next day asking if I had changed my mind about taking the governor in, and I said no again.
There you go. He's refusing to style the governor's hair because he's gay, and she says gay people shouldn't be allowed to get married. And so good on you, Antonio. Good on you. Congratulations. And if you're listening to us on KTRC in Santa Fe, hey, greetings. I would just say hello. And let's see. Oh, American homeowners are getting screwed. This is incredible. And then I will pick up our lines are slanted. I will pick up your calls as soon as I finish this. But this $26 billion mortgage settlement, the big mistake that – now, I don't think this has been signed into law yet. And hopefully they will fix this, because it doesn't say that the states actually have to use the money to give to homeowners who got screwed. Remember, the original idea was any homeowner in America who got screwed by a bank, the banks are going to put $26 billion into this fund, and people would get a couple $1,000. Well, the right-wing states, the Republican states, like Wisconsin, has said, you know, Scott Walker up in Wisconsin said, well, that's great, I'll take the money and I'll use it to balance my budget. I'll use it to pay for tax cuts for billionaires and for big corporations. And now Ohio, John Kasich, same thing, or variation on it. He's set to receive $97 million. He's going to use $75 million of it to bulldoze homes, unoccupied homes, which, by the way, if they're the property of the banks, it's the bank who is responsible for taking care of them. So he's helping the banks out, too. It just doesn't get any weirder than that. Carol in Long Beach, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. For those people who are interested in the whole corporate personhood issue.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Long Beach this weekend, we're having two Move to Amend events with David Cobb. One of them is at 2 o'clock. That's on Sunday at the Unitarian Church on Atherton.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is sponsored by the Occupy Long Beach people, and it will be at the Seroptimus House on the Cal State Long Beach campus. That will be at 4:30.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for the heads up on that, Carol. Great to hear about it and of it, and thank you. Leonard in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Leonard, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. I wanted to say thank you. I called last week. I'm with the Recall Governor Brewer campaign here in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And after we made our call, other brothers and sisters, some moderate Republicans, emailed us to circulate more petitions. And I just wanted to thank you because the debate is today, as you know, here CNN is hosting it, and we're going to have people there. And all I can say is there is hope. There are candles lit here. When people think that Arizona is just about right-wing fanatics, that's not true. There's the great majority of our population are loving, caring people. We don't hate immigrants. We love our brothers and sisters no matter what country they're from. And we're doing something about sick people being kicked off access, or the lady I talked to in a wheelchair yesterday that signed our petition is totally disabled, has three rotting teeth in her mouth that she can't take out. So
wow.
I'm hoping people will go to recallbrewer.com. We're not getting any media attention except for you, but we have hope. So
okay, recallbrewer.com. If you're in Arizona, well, even if you're outside Arizona, you can check it out and see how it's done and throw some support their way. But particularly if you're in Arizona, if you're listening to us on KPHX or watching us on Dish Network or DirecTV or any of the satellite or any of the cable systems that carry us in Arizona, do it. Go to recallbrewer.com. And check it out. Okay, Leonard?
Thank you, Tom. You are a great human being, and just thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for your kind words, Leonard. Janice in Braden, Vermont. Hey, Janice, what's on your mind today?
Hi, it's Brandon, Vermont.
Brandon,
we're
my
apologies.
In the
middle of the state, 2 hours from Montpelier.
I have
why
been
you
there.
Lived in Vermont.
Yeah, I've been there, come to think of
it. I have two things. One is, I don't believe a corporation could be a people because they don't have a spirit or a soul.
Yep.
And another thing is, Jesus did not have a church. He was a prophet.
Yes.
All these churches, I believe, are made to either control, take your money. I prefer to listen to Jesus' sayings and not to go to church.
Well, these are the choices all of us have to make individually. And I think the statistics show that there are more unchurched Christians in America than Christians who go to church. But let's not paint all churches with the same brush. There are, you know, there are denominations, first of all, that are very, very progressive. The United Methodist Church has been getting more progressive. The United Church of Christ is very progressive. They used to, you know, they were in 2004.
I just don't believe in a church.
Yeah, well, I got it. True. I understand.
Truthfully.
I understand. And
Jesus was a prophet. He did not teach from a church. And look at how it got around.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Janice. And thank you for calling and saying it. And that said, there are people, I mean, read Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross, or Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila, or, what's his name? Meister Eckhart, who was a Protestant mystic, as I recall. He might have been Catholic. I think he was Protestant. The German mystic. These are people who operated within the church, but they were so much larger than the church. So it's for each person, you know, and frankly, I think, you know, atheists as well and agnostics. It's like, you know, we all share the same humanity, and that is the fundamental thing that is so often lost. Denver and Nashville. Hey, Denver, what you doing? What's up?
Well, I'm sitting here listening to some of the comments.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I know I'm on the air. Thank you, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard a lot about poor people in West Virginia and all the fracking and all the coal ponds, you know, that silt ponds that have mm-hmm. destroyed their environment.
Yep.
Well, it's taking place in Kentucky, North Carolina, some other. These are things I used to investigate for the government.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking place there.
Mm-hmm.
these fracking thing, these fracking chemicals, and they're nothing but the dregs of distillery products when they distill oil. They're getting into the water table, and they're finally starting to affect down into the valleys of Tennessee.
Where you live.
It seems as though people in general will not take any kind of interest in something unless it's biting them on their derriere.
Yeah.
And that troubles me. That troubles me. But we're seeing people build up around the world right now,
mm-hmm.
and around this country.
Right.
What I don't hear enough of is the problem with AT&T's reconglomeration. They have taken over with their satellite control all communications, it seems, in the world.
Well, it's not. It hasn't gotten that bad, but it is pretty bizarre. I was in Chicago over the weekend, and up in DuPage County, I did a fundraiser along with Governor Quinn for the Democratic Party of DuPage County, which was great fun. And seeing a countywide Democratic Party go from a decade or two ago being basically moribund to now being, you know, vital and filled with a lot of very active and aggressive progressives, which is fabulous. And while I was there, I was trying to use my iPhone as a hotspot, you know, which you can, if you pay an extra 20, 30, 40 bucks a month, whatever it is for 4 gigabytes a month worth of service. I'm not one of those unlimited usage people that AT&T is characterizing as leeches. I'm actually paying for the use so that I could use it as a hotspot, because otherwise the hotels charge you 12 bucks a night, you know, for local Wi-Fi. And I thought, you know, why pay that when I'm already paying that to AT&T? So I plug it in and I'm getting a throughput of 1.5 kilobytes per second. That's slower than I used to get on dial-up. And I call up AT&T and I said, you know, what's after sitting on hold for 45 minutes, literally. And the woman said, well, your service seems to have been slowed down because last month you were in Europe. And I said, what's that got to do with anything? I paid for that, you know? It's like, and she said, well, I'll fix that. And then I got back and I tried it, and it's still the same thing. It's just incredibly mind-bogglingly slow. In Europe, what they do is they do not allow these kinds of monopolies that have formed in the United States. They say if you're a common carrier, we used to use that phrase a lot in the United States.
Right.
If you've got wires that are going through the rights of way, through underneath the roads that we the people maintain, or wireless that is going through the air that we the people own, then you have to, at a reasonable price, you have to allow any competing company who competes with you to use your services. You charge them for it, but you let them use it. And that's why, for what I'm paying $200 a month for here in the U.S., you can get in France for $40 a month, and it works. Thanks for the call, Denver.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's just incredible. And this is welfare. This is really corporate welfare when you say to a big company like AT&T, okay, we're going to protect you from competition. The place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Ray in Dartmouth, Mass. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Good, Tom. How are you?
Great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Well, I haven't heard you talk about this. I'm sure it's on the docket that you want to talk about the corporate tax reform that President Obama is going to be putting forward, where he drops the top marginal corporate tax from 35% down to 28%, but while doing so, he's also going to close a ton of loopholes where he says it's essentially going to actually increase revenue. I just wanted to get your take on that.
About a half hour ago, I did a whole riff on this. I played a clip from John Kennedy in 1960, who did the exact same thing on rich people, and it actually did produce more revenue. Obama is saying that it's going to be revenue neutral, but you know, taxes do two things. We have taxes for two reasons. One reason is to fund government, you know, to pay for the cost of government. The second reason, which isn't so often discussed, is basically social engineering. It's to get businesses and individuals to do things that we want them to do and not to do things we don't want them to do. So we raise taxes on cigarettes because we don't want people smoking cigarettes. and we lower taxes. We give a tax deduction on home mortgages because we want people to buy homes because it's a great way to build equity over the course of your lifetime. And
right.
And so what President Obama is proposing to do is to say, if you're a corporation that's doing manufacturing in the United States, your top tax rate is going to drop from 35 down to 25%. If you're manufacturing outside the United States, however, right now you're paying no tax, you're going to have to start paying 28% tax. So it would be an advantage for you to move your manufacturing inside the United States. And this is, you know, this is, I think it's brilliant. And the fact that our top tax rate is 35%, but nobody pays it, GE's tax return that they submitted to the Internal Revenue Service when it was printed out and delivered was 19.5 feet high. And I guarantee you, 16 feet of it was probably loopholes that GE itself got lobbied into legislation. And if Obama starts closing up those loopholes and these companies start paying taxes, and even if it's revenue neutral, I mean, this is what he's saying to the Republicans. We're not going to collect any more taxes. We're not going to collect any less taxes, but we're going to modify the behavior of these corporations with these taxes. I think it's brilliant because how are Republicans going to say no to that? How are they going to oppose it?
My second question to you is, he's doing this at a time of an election year, and we all know how hard it is to get anything done in this Congress, especially tax reform. Could this be a game plan where he says, look, I want to lower corporate taxes, I want to make it more business friendly, and still these Republicans here in the House and Senate don't want to do anything?
Right. Because right now the corporations love the tax code the way it is. They love the fact that they can complain about the top 35% tax rate, which nobody pays. They love the fact that they've got, you know, 19.5 feet worth of loopholes for General Electric specifically, and others. They like it the way it is. And so the Republicans, if they're dancing to the tune of, you know, multimillionaire K Street lobbyists like Grover Norquist, they're going to oppose this, even though it's a lowering of the top tax rate. And if they oppose it, it's going to be a win for Obama. On the other hand, if they do the simple politics of it, the political math, and say, okay, it's lowering taxes, but it's not changing income, and it's closing up loopholes, and it's going to cause more jobs to come back to the United States, I guess we better go along with this, then it's going to be played as a win for Obama. So it's jujitsu. You know, President Obama, it's Aikido. He's using the energy of his opponent and flipping him over his own shoulder. I think it's brilliant, Ray. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll see. I mean, you know, the devil's going to be in the details, right? Just like with this thing where the banksters are paying $26 billion, excuse me, and now Ohio is going to say, and Scott Walker up in Wisconsin, they're saying, okay, great, we'll take the money, but we're not going to give it to the people who got screwed on their mortgages. We're going to instead, you know, use it for the state, you know, so that we can give more tax breaks to rich people and billionaires. Not good. Not good. But anyway. Kiara in New York City. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Greetings. It's like the key in the door, Kiara.
Oh, Kiara. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yes.
So what's up?
Thank you. I have 2 points to ask. So can you share your views on education and unions? And the second point is, why has being a teacher become such a dirty word in the last 3 years? Because I'm an educator here in New York.
Yeah.
I work in an elementary school, and I'm also the union rep.
And yeah,
so
I can tell you,
yeah.
There's two reasons why being a teacher has become a dirty word in America, at least among conservatives. One is they want for-profit corporations to get that state money rather than your school. They want some buddy of theirs to make money off it, who then will recycle that money back through politicians in the form of campaign contributions and things. There's money to be made in education, and they resent the fact that it's part of the commons. And number two, you're unionized, and they're trying to destroy all the unions because they know that the unions are providing, they're one of the last bulwarks for the Democratic Party. Here's the simple story that you need to tell anybody who says, unionized teachers make too much quack, quack, quack. The two countries in the world, and you can Google this, there was a great op-ed about this in the New York Times just a month or so ago. The two countries in the world that have the highest high school graduate educational scores on earth are Finland and Singapore. And in Finland and Singapore, the teachers, number one, are 100% unionized, and number two, make on average the same as medical doctors make, and number three, it's just about as hard to become a teacher in those countries, and it's as high status a profession as it is being a medical doctor. And I look at our country and I say, why is it that our future, which is our kids, in other words, our teachers, the people who are holding our future in their hands, are not the most highly paid among us. And our police officers, the people who hold our safety in our hands, and are not the most highly paid among us. If we were to start paying police officers and teachers the way that we pay physicians and dentists and you know, accountants or banksters or, you know, fill in the blank, if we were to start paying them well and honoring them, you would see, you know, you would see a reformation, a renaissance in America. There, you know, you wouldn't have the kind of people going into policing who are going in because they're not there for the money. They're there because they want to be able to beat people up. And you would have, you know, not that the world's best teachers are just there for the money, but the fact of the matter is that a lot of people are graduating from college with $50,000, $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 in debt because of the insane education system we have, higher education system we have, and they look at teaching and they say, I can't make enough money to pay off my debts. And so they're going into other professions, really, really bright people. And so we need to be paying our teachers better, and we need to be honoring them. Okay, Kiara?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Watching bounce, bounce, bounce on the screen in front of me. It's an amazing day. Eric Zimmerman is on the line with Taxpayer.net, Senior Policy Analyst for Taxpayers for Common Sense, which sounds to me like another Tea Party or conservative or anti-tax or whatever you want to call it group. Eric, is that it?
Not exactly. Yeah, we consider ourselves a nonpartisan budget watchdog trying to protect taxpayers across the country.
So do you want the 15% capital gains rate that Mitt Romney pays raised up to the 35% rate that Warren Buffett's secretary pays?
Well, we fancy ourselves more of a spending organization. We don't do a whole lot on the tax side of the ledger. So we're trying to reduce wasteful
spending. So you want spending cut to the point where Mitt Romney's 15% doesn't have to go up?
That's a possibility.
I see. Okay. So, it gives us a calibration of your politics. You're upset about this highway. Actually, there's two highway bills. There's one that the Democrats are proposing, one the Republicans are proposing. Your thoughts?
Well, we're basically opposed to both. Both essentially are unpaid for on the House side of the ledger. They've proposed the House has proposed a number of provisions related to the exploration of energy and some other unrelated to transportation provisions in order to make up some $40 billion gap in funding on that side. And we're opposed to that for a number of reasons. And on the Senate side, it's a similar story, and gas tax revenues won't be nearly enough to pay for that bill either. And they've got kind of a smorgasbord of provisions that they believe would offset the added cost of their bill relative to gas tax receipts, and we don't believe that's going to be effective either.
What's wrong with using gas taxes to pay for highways?
Well, we love gas tax and believe that it's a user fee, and that's what its purpose should be for. The problem that we're facing now is gas tax revenues are flattening out as people drive less and cars become more efficient, and the appetite for spending is not decreasing or flattening out.
Isn't the biggest problem really that the gas tax was fixed at 18 cents back 30 years ago, and it should have been set at 6%? And instead, over time, as the price of gas has gone up, the revenue from the gas tax has not gone up a penny?
Well, there certainly is a good argument to be made for indexing the gas tax, either a lot of people argue to the increase in the cost of construction materials, something that would help it reflect better the increased cost of construction.
Why not just make it a percentage of the cost of gasoline like most countries do?
Well,
every other country does.
We're happy to explore any option that would essentially increase the user fee to the point where there's enough funding coming in through the gas tax in order to pay for the demands and the needs of the nation's infrastructure system.
So then question number two, why is it that there is so much enthusiasm for building a pipeline across America that will move oil quickly? You know, a mass transit for oil system from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, to refineries that whose principal product is gasoline for export. Gasoline has now gone from being a product that 16 years ago we were importing to the number one manufactured export of our nation right now. So our domestic oil companies, the companies that are operating within the United States who refine gasoline, are exporting oil or exporting gasoline in order to keep supplies low and prices high in the United States. Why is it that we're focusing on moving oil rapidly to the benefit and profit of these oil companies when we have a gasoline glut? And we're not talking about moving people rapidly, high-speed rail. Why not use the gasoline taxes from, why not, number one, index gasoline taxes or make them a percentage so that they're actually generating more revenue? And number two, use that money to go to the next generation of transportation, like China has just inaugurated over 5,000 miles of high-speed rail. They built a high-speed rail that's the equivalent of New York to Chicago, and you can make the trip in about 6 hours. That would be incredible for the United States to have a New York to Chicago high-speed rail line. Why don't we do that? Why are we having this 19th-century argument about, you know, one of John Rockefeller's oil lines?
Well, I think what we're most concerned with in that debate is whether or not running the pipeline is actually a sensible way to try and raise any revenue to pay for a transportation system. In addition, I think that there certainly is a lot to be said for how we set priorities regarding transportation in this country, coming to a better place where we have a little bit more agreement on what the future of the transportation system.
So, you know, in the abstract, that all sounds very kind of wishy-washy. What are you really saying?
Well, I believe that we need a transportation system that's paid for. We need to come to agreement on what that looks like relative to what we're willing to pay for it. So
what would you suggest?
In regards to what?
A transportation system that, you know, a 21st transportation system for the 21st century in the United States.
Well, certainly, I do believe that there is a opportunity to index the gas tax, that increasing the amount we bring in user fees. However, the problem with that solution is that there's fairly wide agreement that's never going to bring in enough relative to what we probably need to be spending in order to ensure that we remain competitive in the global marketplace.
Well, you know, Germany is incredibly competitive with us. They're kicking our ass. And gasoline is $8 or $9 a gallon in Germany, and more than three quarters of that price is tax.
Sure, and I mean it's quite obvious that we just haven't made the same decisions in this country relative to how we choose to
tax. No, and you get on German rail. I mean, you can sit on the German. I've done it. You know, I do it every year. You could sit on high speed German rail and sit there with a glass of wine sitting on the table in front of you, and it doesn't even tremble, and you can have a quiet conversation with the person sitting next to you. You take Amtrak up and down the East Coast, and it's bang, 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 knock around. Whoops, sorry, I fell on you. Because the rails are privatized, and Amtrak has to rent these old rails that aren't being maintained, and in part because, you know, as a country, we've said, you know, we're not going to really subsidize mass transportation. We'd rather have everybody driving cars and creating pollution and move a 6,000-pound piece of steel around to transport 150-pound person. This makes no sense to me.
Yeah, well, it is obvious that there's been a lack of commitment to figuring out how to adequately fund our next generation.
Dwight Eisenhower, in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower looked at the nation and said, if we're going to build this country out, if we're going to grow our way out of the massive debt that we had from World War II, we were at 127% of GDP in terms of our debt. It was way bigger than it is today right now. And Dwight Eisenhower said, if we're going to grow our way out of this, we need a 20th century transportation system. And in the 1950s, he built the interstate highway system. Isn't it time for us to look at where we're at right now and say, you know, we've got this huge debt. It's not as bad as it was after World War II. But let's do what Dwight Eisenhower did, borrow a little more money and spend it to build a 21st century transportation system and infrastructure, which will then grow the economy to the point that there's more people working, more people paying taxes, and that debt will be paid off as it was by 1955.
Well, our take is we'd like to see it paid for. We'd like to see users.
So you want the money first
from the system, not first, but at least to have some, you know, some a serious conversation about how we're going to get.
Do you believe that growing an economy will increase taxes, tax revenue?
Sure. Sure, absolutely.
So arguably you're in favor of the Eisenhower solution, which is borrow more money and spend it on infrastructure, which is going to generate economic activity.
Well, I mean, the borrowing is difficult. I mean, it's hard to look at a $15 trillion debt and assume that we should borrow more in order to have that be the solution.
It's no problem for the United States. People are still buying our bonds and we're paying virtually nothing.
Sure.
People want our debt. Our debt is not harming us in any way.
Well, it's our take that you know, we don't, in the long term, that this is better paid for by the users of the system, and we should continue down the path that we've been using for the last, you know, 50 years.
So you don't want to expand the users of the system and say, you know, we're going to make something that's going to work for everybody.
That's not what I'm saying at all, no.
You just want to nail the people who drive cars. No?
No, okay. I mean, we just want a system that's paid for by users. I mean,
okay, I got it. Eric Zimmerman, taxpayer.net. You can read about it all there. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do we do? That's an interesting question. I think that what we're looking at here are dueling ideologies, not dueling plans. Okay, just a couple of short clips for you, and then I want to pick up some phone calls. But Mitt Romney, somebody must have given him some good vitamins or something. You know, suddenly his brain started working. Just for a moment, this is only 8 seconds long, but just for a moment, Mitt Romney's brain was working, and he was pushing back on Rick Snyder and Scott Walker and Rick Scott and John Kasich and all the other crazy right-wing Republicans. 24 states where crazy right-wing Republicans have laid off since President Obama became president 700,000 government employees and have cut taxes on rich people and corporations and cut spending in their states. And guess what? All of those states have seen their unemployment rates suffer as a result of it, have seen their GDP suffer as a result of it. And here's Mitt Romney explaining to them why.
If you just cut, if all you're thinking about doing is cutting spending, why, as you cut spending, you'll slow down the economy.
Wow. Wow. Mitt Romney, a moment of lucidity. I think, you know, the sky is opening. This is incredible. And here's another one. Pat Robertson, the guy who built an empire with his Christian Broadcasting Network, sold it for $1 billion. Pat Robertson's worth $1 billion. This is how much money you can make in the nonprofit religious broadcasting business. $1,000 million. And Pat Robertson commenting on the banks. Now, you know, maybe he had a lot of that money invested when the stock market crashed. Who knows? But he's got a burr under his tail about the banksters.
Iceland. They are putting people in jail. They are putting, like, prime ministers being indicted. They're going after bankers. The people
really?
Said, yeah, I said, those banks were ripping us off. We don't like what they did. They brought our country to ruin. And now Iceland suddenly is turning around. Their GDP is growing, and they look like a big success story. Isn't that amazing?
Think we could learn something?
We sure could. We could start putting some of those bankers in jail.
Pat Robertson puts out those bankers in jail. I don't need clips of Nancy Pelosi. I got Mitt Romney and Pat Robertson. Oh, amazing. Michael, listening on KBAI in Bellingham, Washington, it says here, you disagree with me. You want to complain about progressive media? Really?
No. Actually, Tom, I love what you do. And what I'm talking about in general is what I see in the kind of the broad swath of progressive media. You know, I could name a bunch of names of...
I'd rather you didn't.
The people, the talk show host in the progressive end.
Michael, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you have a complaint or a concern or a disagreement with me or this program, I am more than pleased to discuss it with you. If it has to do with anybody else's show, I don't listen to many of them. I don't, you know, I spend 15 hours a day doing this show, and
yeah,
I can't defend.
Please bear with me, if you will, and just hear what my concern is, because
if you put it in the abstract, please, not the specific.
Abstract, but it is specific. The specific issue is that on your program, you and your callers educate the listener. But on many of the progressive programs, All it is seems to be is a blow-by-blow rebuttal of the GOP clown show.
Yeah,
and we don't.
Michael, I'm sorry. I can't. I'm gonna drop the call. With apologies. I realize it sounds discourteous, but I just I can't be in a position of defending or attacking other shows that I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's just I can't do that. Sandy in Detroit. Hey, Sandy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First, thank you for your show. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm calling about the national mortgage settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just a matter of the states taking this money and using it as they will. I'm a realtor, and I'm in the Detroit area, and had my worst year ever last year because of prices.
Sure.
But I had a mortgage with Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
We were just notified by our management of this new program, and I don't know if you're aware of the criteria to qualify you, but it's being underwater on your mortgage, having an interest rate over 5.25%, and being up to date on your mortgage. I qualify in all 3 points.
Okay.
Bank of America sold my mortgage 2 months ago. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist as a rule.
So you think that they sold the mortgage that would qualify for refinancing?
I actually
so they took their money and ran.
Sure. I think they have a computer program that would.
Oh, I count on it. Count on it. I'm not. You know, Sandy. I don't think you'd have to be a conspiracy theorist to think that. I think that's common sense. Did the person that they send it or the corporation that they sold it to, does that company have to participate in this program?
No, they do not.
They do not. Okay. Bingo.
No, Bank of America sold it to GreenTree. GreenTree is not one of the five.
One of the five defendants. Okay, so these companies are probably shedding these mortgages as fast as they possibly can and have been for a couple of months.
Yep. That's exactly what they're doing.
Surprise, surprise.
I do.
Yeah.
I've written to John Dingell, but I have very little.
I would call, if John Dingell is your member of Congress, I would call his office or I would visit one of his local offices, and I would also call Debbie Stabenow's office. She's a very, very good senator who represents the state of Michigan. And I would also, is it Carl Levin?
Yes.
Carl Levin is your other senator. I would also visit his local offices and ask for some help. They all have people who do what are called constituent services, to help out people like yourself. Although I think that what has happened is the banksters have gamed the system and, they're screwing the average person again. But
they really are. And you know what? I'm 71 years old. I'm still working. I'm still working very, very hard.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's hard to make a living, you know.
Yeah. My goodness.
Well, thank you for listening. I just wanted to let you know what was going on.
Thank you for the heads up, Sandy. And for all of our other listeners, if you are thinking of getting into this program, find out if your banksters have sold their mortgage yet. Get on that right away. Don't get caught like Sandy did. That's just a horrible story or a sad story. Sandy, thank you very much for calling and sharing that. We'll be right back. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back in just a moment with, President Obama, his new tax code, and it's been a bad year for journalists. I got to tell you about this. So get out of your bed, boys, go to the ride. I fall out my place, I stay all night. Yeah. Occupying the media, Tom Hartman here with you. I mentioned last year was a bad year for journalists. 46 journalists were killed in 2011. In addition, the number of journalists who were arrested, 15-year high. Why? Because of journalists being arrested during the Occupy movement here in the United States. That's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. That all the changes the Occupy movement has brought about, and one of them is that America is now considered one of the more hostile countries in the world to be a journalist. Certainly one of the among the most in the developed world. Wow. Amazing. Tony in Los Angeles. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, just wanted to comment on that Mitt Romney clip you were playing a little while ago.
Okay, since it's only 8 seconds long, let me play it again. Because a lot of people, tune in when they get in their cars and whatnot, so they'll know what we're talking about. Here it is right here.
If you just cut, if all you're thinking about doing is cutting spending, why, as you cut spending, you'll slow down the economy.
Okay, back to you, Tony.
Do I need to get my ears checked? Did I hear that right?
I'm guessing that there was, you know, there were caveats and wobbles and flip-flops that followed it. I don't know what they were. I don't have the whole thing in context. He is right about what that little 8 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now thanks for the ammunition. I've got something to tell my libertarian and Republican friends.
Yeah.
Whenever I get in spat with them now.
Yeah, Mitt Romney says if you just cut, you're going to slow down the economy. And surprise, surprise, that's what happens. It's happened at 24. You know, we've seen this laboratory in the States. I did a whole, you can find a YouTube of this on the internet. I did a whole YouTube thing on this, how we have 24 states that have cut spending in the last 3 years during the Obama administration, all of them states that are run largely or mostly by Republicans, and 25 states that have increased spending and increased taxes during the last 3 years, and then one state that has been just basically flat, that has done none of the above. And the 24 states that cut spending and cut taxes have all seen their unemployment get worse, and they've seen their GDP, their economic activity, drop, in other words, get worse. And the 25 states that were run mostly by Democrats that have raised taxes and increased spending, and I was pleased to hear over the weekend on Saturday, I did I keynoted a speech for the DuPage Democratic Party in, you know, just north of Chicago, and Governor Pat Quinn preceded me as the speaker, and then I spoke. And he said some very nice things about me, which I was very grateful for, but he also said that our state has raised taxes and increased spending, and the result has been increased economic activity and lower unemployment. He just came right out and said it. He's proud of it. And I think that it is, and we've seen this in the states. The states have demonstrated this. We have our own laboratory right here in the United States. And yet still you hear Republicans running around saying, no, we need to do America what the bankers are doing to Greece. You know, lay off 100,000 people. That'll help increase tax revenues. No, don't think so. So, yeah, you got some ammunition. Go ahead, Tony.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Thanks a lot for the call. Oh, Jacob says he's got the whole Romney clip in context. Here it is. It's 15 seconds.
If you just cut, if all you're thinking about doing is cutting spending, why, as you cut spending, you'll slow down the economy. So you have to, at the same time, create pro-growth tax policies. And so the Simpson-Bowles Commission attempted to do that in their own way.
And Simpson-Bowles, of course, first of all, that's a lie, because the Simpson-Bowles Commission never issued a report. It blows my mind. This is one of the reasons why I scream at the TV so much on Sunday mornings, because they get these Republicans on and they say, well, the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommended privatizing Social Security, you know, and they recommended privatizing Medicare. And David Gregory or whoever it may be, you know, that whatever talking head on TV is sitting there going, No, the Simpson-Bowles Commission was unable to come to a conclusion. So Simpson and Bowles by themselves issued an unofficial report which said, why don't you hand Wall Street, the Social Security program and the Medicare program and, quack, quack, quack. But it was a couple of right-wing wackadoodles. The people who were on the commission, Jan Schakowsky was on that commission. She would not go along with the hearing, with the idiotic result. Her and I think six other people, or at least five other people, they couldn't get the majority that they needed, or the supermajority that they needed, to issue a report. So Simpson-Bowles never issued a report, although Mitt Romney wants to pretend that they did, and therefore you need some pro-growth tax policies like cutting taxes on rich people like Mitt Romney and doing away with Social Security, Medicare, and all those socialist programs. Sam in Cummings, Michigan. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I got my question about the big oil companies. And
sir,
my question is, do they own all of the oil rights for oil extraction out of the United States?
No, they buy them individually, either from individual property owners or from the federal or state government, depending on who owns the land.
Okay, well, then they lease it, and they have the opportunity to go in there and drill and pull oil if they want to.
That's right.
I guess, Tom, my question is, I don't have enough money myself to go out and buy a drill rig and build a refinery, but what happens if we take a vote, get some taxpayer dollars, and buy our own drilling equipment, hire some men to operate it, build our own refineries, sell it at a white man's price?
Let's recalibrate that phrase. The racist language doesn't help your argument, Sam.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. But what I meant was about a normal price and to hell with the big oil companies.
Yeah. No. What you're arguing, and thank you for the call, Sam. What you're arguing is doing what Norway has done, what Brazil has done, what Venezuela has done. What you're arguing is doing what the democratically elected governments of Iran and Iraq did back in the early 50s, which is why we overthrew them on behalf of the big oil companies and installed the Shah in Iran and installed Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And, you know, what you're advocating is common sense. Therefore, it won't happen. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Michael in Seattle. Hey, Michael, what's up? Michael?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, I was just, I heard you the other day talk about the connection between the, the Koch brothers and their big-time Wall Street spenders influencing gasoline prices because of the Obama administration turning down the pipeline.
Yeah, this wasn't so much the Koch brothers. It was the American Petroleum Institute. It was whatever the trade association was. And then last week or the week before, the head of Shell Oil came out and said, look for $4 and $5 a gallon gas or words to that effect.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that there was a governor in one of the states that had said, I thought the quote was something like, there's going to be political retribution if you pay it, something
it
like
It wasn't
that.
The governor. That was the head of the Petroleum Association, the name of the trade association is, the American Petroleum Institute or whatever it is. He said that. He said, okay, if Obama doesn't approve the Keystone XL pipeline, there will be political consequences. That was his phrase.
Right.
And that's what we're seeing right now. They're jacking up the price of gasoline.
So much. I'm sorry?
That's what you're seeing right now. They're jacking up the price of gasoline. This is the political payback.
Jacking it up and, right.
Yep. Yeah.
Right for the political season ahead. So.
There you go. That's absolutely what's going on. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Anna, listening on KPHX in Cave Creek, Arizona?
Yes.
Hey,
Arizona,
I used to spend a lot of time in Cave Creek. It's a beautiful little town.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's wonder. It is a little town, and a wonderful little town. Anyway, you know, Mesa, by the way, is a Mormon stronghold. So if he doesn't do well there, he's in a lot of trouble. There should be a lot of cheering for him, for Mitt.
Well, I think the large number of Mormons in Arizona in general is one of the reasons why he's still 3 points above Santorum.
I'm related to way too many of them. Anyway, they're good people.
Yeah, of course.
The Rick Santorum thing, no one has brought up the subject. No contraception, and of course I'm referring to condoms, would permit the spread of sexually transmitted diseases like AIDS, the STD, syphilis, gonorrhea, which even third world countries are trying to get a handle on, and he doesn't want any kind of contraception. I mean, is he promoting the spread of AIDS? I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Well, Rick Santorum's coming from the place that many conservatives come from, which is the idea that people are basically helpless animals who have lower instincts, and we need to control them and regulate them in ways that will cause them not to act stupidly, acting stupidly in this case being sexually promiscuous. And, you know, uh-huh. I have greater faith in the human race, frankly.
No access to it, the very basic need, condoms, and I hope, you know, they all say, well, abstinence. Well, it didn't work for Sarah Palin's daughter. Kids are going to be active. There's, no matter what you do, young people are going, adults,
yeah,
we're all going to be active. I throw myself in that as well. And many times people don't use protection.
Yeah.
And according to him, no contraception, which would be a condom. And I just see that as a disease.
I hate being the defender of Rick Santorum, but I think his position is a little more nuanced than that. I think he's saying that he doesn't want the federal government paying for contraception.
And I know a lot of schools in different places give access to condoms, and I just thought it was very strange.
His concern, I don't think this is a totally illegitimate concern. His concern is that the message that is being sent is, hey, sex is fun, sex is great, and if you just do this, sex becomes totally safe. And the fact of the matter is that even if you're using condoms, condoms break, sex can be dangerous.
Of course.
And so what we need is a rational middle ground of good, high-quality sex education and the availability of birth control, in my personal opinion. But, you know, we're not having that middle ground because of this fight.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service and more of your calls right after this.
Take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Talk Radio News brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Alan Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And just by coincidence, Alan Ratner's on the line with us from the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Alan, what's going on in the world?
Well, I think the most interesting thing is the president made a statement on taxes today, and the tax plan was released by Tim Geithner. Basically, the president said everyone gets a fair shot, everyone gets a tax code that rewards companies who invest and create job growth in America. They wanted to simplify the tax code, and they want to eliminate dozens of loopholes. Well, Romney released his tax plan today, although he's done some broad outlines. He wants a 20% across-the-board individual tax rate. He wants the top rate to go from 28% to 23.4%, and the bottom to go from 10 to 8%. Now, the Republicans today, what they did is they said, well, because Secretary Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, released the plan instead of the president releasing the plan and unveiling the plan, that this has signaled that it's a lower priority of the Obama administration.
What?
Now, you really are. I'm not kidding.
Really?
That is really what they said.
Yeah, but, you know, what they say is irrelevant. The question is, how are the Republicans going to say the president wants to lower the top corporate tax rate from 35% down to 28%, and he wants to close up some loopholes, and therefore we're opposed to it? How can they possibly say that?
Well, they can't, and so therefore they said that he's not really giving this high priority. I mean,
oh, so
they're nothing to go after him with.
So they're not going to oppose it. They're just going to refuse to vote on it because he didn't give it a high enough priority?
Well, I'm not sure what they're going to do about the vote, but it's going to be very hard for them not to vote on it.
Yeah.
But you never, I mean, look, they'll come up with anything. Anyhow, Secretary Geithner said that we have the highest tax among developed countries in terms of corporate statutory tax, and they also want no more than 25% for factories.
Now, the one thing,
R&D manufacturing.
You know, the one thing that is missing in all this, we do have the highest income tax rate for corporations among the OECD nations. The average is around 20, 22%, 20, 24%, something like that. But most of those countries also have VAT taxes. So their corporations are paying a lot of taxes on every stage of production during the manufacturing process.
Those value-added taxes, they'll kill you in Europe.
Well, it's not just that they'll kill us. It's that, you know, the average corporation in Europe is probably paying 25, 30, 35, maybe 40% in taxes, even though their top marginal income tax rate is only 20%. So if we drop our income tax rate and we don't have a VAT tax, we're going to continue to have, you know, right now, American corporations pay the second lowest amount of taxes of all the OECD nations. We're going to get even lower than that. And I really think we need to be looking at a VAT tax, but that's a whole other discussion. Anyhow, back to you.
One thing that, they want this global minimum tax, and Jeff was both at the Geithner event and the Carney event afterwards through the White House and Treasury Department, and no one will say yet what percentage that global minimum tax is going to be. So we don't know it yet.
Right.
And probably won't know it until the legislation actually comes forward. Now, it's interesting, the first former First Lady and now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is going to stop in London. There's a conference on Somalia and their period of transition. Then she's going to Tunisia for a forum called Friends of Syria. Russia was invited but won't go. And also, by the way, Jay Carney said today that the president opposes the militarization of Syria and that Syria is a different situation than Libya. I'm not sure what that means, but the White House is not planning, at least that we know of, through the back door, arming the Syrians. The Secretary of State is going to be going to Algeria and Morocco. Now, also, today, Supreme Court, 6-3, the police officers Act cannot be sued if they used a defective warrant to conduct a search. So essentially, there was the police were going after a potential gang member, a foster son of a woman, looking for a gang for weapons. They found her weapon, and then they proceeded on going after her. And the three dissenters were Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Kagan.
And so the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the police, basically, on this, giving them more latitude.
Exactly, even if they have a defective warrant. Well, what is to say that a police officer, knowing that they can get one kind of warrant but not another, isn't going to go for a particular warrant, and then when they find something they're looking for or they want or will improve whatever, then they say, oh, sorry, it was a defective warrant.
It's going to be the new normal, just like I forget the name of the case. It was Casey or something. It was the case where the Supreme Court ruled that if a police officer has probable cause to believe that a crime is being committed, they can
exactly.
They can. And so now they'll say, you know, you see it on TV on the cop shows, right? They'll come up to the house and bang on the door and nothing happens, and they go, hey, does that smell like pot to you? Yeah, it smells like pot to me. Okay, let's bust in the door. Oh, gee, I guess it's not pot. Oh, well, it smelled like it to me. And, you know, and now they're legal. So it's like they'll come up with, you're right, I think that's going to be the new normal.
Now, as you know, the Supreme Court is going to be hearing the case about the health care at the end of March, and Families USA is doing a radio row. Well, America's for Prosperity, that's Karl Rove's organization, on March 27th is organizing a march with the Tea Party Express, Family Research Council, Concerned Women for America, Americans for Tax Reform, and other wonderful organizations.
A march where?
It's going to be on the mall at the same time the Supreme Court is, and this march is going to be, of course, against health care.
Oh, jeez.
You know,
I'm telling you, they're going to punt it to 2014.
Well, I think they are. I think they are, and there's evidence that they will because of this particular rule that says that you can't stop a tax unless the tax has actually been enforced.
Right.
So if they consider the health care bill a tax, then they will not issue
right.
it to 2014.
When the Supreme Court hires their own lawyers, to argue in front of them and sets aside time for those lawyers, you got to know that something's up. you think? Ellen Ratner with the Talk Ready News Service, brought to you by the new book Self Empowerment by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Ellen, thanks so much for dropping by. Ellen? Oh, Ellen's gone. Boy, she was in a hurry. Okay, we'll be back. We're going to talk about birth control and all that kind of stuff. Democrats for Life will be with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The whole pro-life, pro-choice debate and stuff in general has come into bright relief with this proposal, which seems to have stalled out in Virginia, about transvaginal ultrasounds, and arguably far more importantly with the president saying that hospitals and other non-specifically religious organizations, non-theological organizations, but doing the work that their theology dictates, heal the sick, for example, that they have to, their insurance companies have to, or their insurance policies have to provide contraception to their employees, whether they pay for it or not, has brought a lot of this stuff into the light. And most of what we hear is that, oh, there's a bunch of Republicans who are opposed to this, and it's just the Republicans in Virginia, it's Republicans here. And a lot of people don't realize that there is a substantial number of Democrats who consider themselves pro-life. And this is an issue that actually crosses partisan lines. And I wanted to have a conversation about that. Kristen Day is with us. She's the executive director of Democrats for Life, their website, democratsforlife.org. And Kristen, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on today.
Thanks for joining us. I was fascinated to see on your website that this is one of the knocks on the so-called pro-life movement. Let's call it that. that some people say, oh, those people are only concerned about babies before they're born, right? And after they're born, they're not. And you have a pretty thoughtful screed or commentary on your homepage about how can we call ourselves pro-life if we're not trying to, you know, end hunger in the third world, and if we're not trying to deal with hunger here in the United States and help people have a quality life from the moment they're born as well as before they're born.
Right, absolutely. And I think, you know, for the pro-life movement is so focused really on just the abortion issue. And we added a new board member last year, and she describes herself as whole life. And, you know, we really have to look at the whole package. It's not just about abortion. It's about people having enough money to afford food and to provide for their family. And, you know, it's quite a bit broader than that. And, you know, another good example is when we have been working for several years on the Pregnant Woman Support Act. And when it came time to it, Senator Casey included it in the health care bill. And the act provided more support for pregnant women, and it made sure that they had the tools to carry the pregnancy to term instead of seeking abortion. And we didn't have any pro-life support from other pro-life groups on that bill, which was very interesting.
Yeah, because let's be helpful. Let's offer. That's sad.
Yeah,
that's actually very sad. The conversation in America, we haven't, I don't think since Roe v. Wade, there was a lot of yelling and screaming after Roe v. Wade, and arguably justly so. I mean, this was the Supreme Court basically coming up with this three trimester rule and defining things in ways that I think are the province of the legislature. Even though I largely agree with the Roe v. Wade decision, I still think that it was bad judicial whatever. In fact, Phyllis Schlafly and I have had some interesting conversations on that. We agree on that point. I don't think the Supreme Court should even have had the power to do that. But that said, there is this spectrum of thought in the United States. You point out on your website, most Democrats are in favor of some control over abortion. I don't think that most people think that, at least in the last trimester of life, or of pregnancy, rather, where a fetus is definitely viable, that unless there's some real genuine crisis that is endangering the life of the fetus or the mother or both, I think it's not inappropriate for the state to say, you know, we actually, society plays a role here. Then on the other end of that spectrum, there are people who say, you know, for the Catholic Church, for example, at the moment that somebody is married, basically, you know, at the moment of the desire to hop into bed together, that's really when the baby is not literally created, but is conceived, and therefore birth control should not be used because that's interfering with God's will and thus stopping that baby from coming into life. And then there's all these little micro steps in between, you know, at fertilization, at implantation, at what the Catholic Church used to call quickening around the third month, those kind of things.
Right.
What are your thoughts on how to bring about a reasonable debate in the United States about some of these issues that isn't grounded in religion, but is grounded in science and law?
When you look at science, though, the ultrasound machine really started. That's what really started to change people's hearts and minds on the issue of abortion. You know, I have three children now, and when I was pregnant with my first child, I had an ultrasound at 20 weeks, as many women do, and I brought the picture home to my neighbor, who's, an educated woman in her, 30s, and she looked at the picture and couldn't believe that the baby was so developed.
Sure.
Because it actually looks like a child, and, you know, so women all along have been told that it's only cells,
right.
And what's growing inside you is only cells, and it's not a baby, and, you know, to abort it, you should not even have second thoughts about doing that. But
right.
I think the more, I think women's groups have done a disservice by continuing to, perpetuate that myth.
Well, on the other hand, there is a point where it is only cells.
Pardon me?
There is a point where it is only cells. In the first few weeks of after conception, you've just got a blob of tissue.
Well, people can argue that, but some people would say differently. For example, again, as a mother of three, I've had some very early ultrasounds because my first pregnancy resulted in a miscarriage, and so they were very cautious when I was pregnant again. And so I did have one of those vaginal ultrasounds that people are talking about all the time now at 6 weeks, which is actually 4 weeks because the first 2 weeks you're not actually pregnant in the countdown cycle. And you can see the heart beating.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see the little baby. You can see the formation of the baby at that early when it's actually 4 weeks.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing with that. And I'm assuming that you're not disagreeing with the fact that 3 days in, it's a blob of cells.
Well, people have different opinions on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the question is, I guess, is, you know, how do we bring about a conversation about the role of the state in these issues and also the issue of contraception? How does that?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the biggest problem right now we face with those issues is the fact that it's so politicized. And you have the Democratic Party and the pro-choice movement on one side, and then you have the Republican Party and the pro-life movement on the other. And neither side really wants to come to a resolution because it's good for politics, it's good to get people to the polls, you know, it's good for raising money.
Yeah.
You know, and I always said when I started Democrats for Life, I wanted to put myself out of business. Because I really do feel that we really need to solve these important issues. We need to provide more support for women. We need to, you know, make sure that their prevention is there, that, you know, women who don't want to get pregnant, there is some availability of prevention mechanisms. And, you know, that's the way we are going to end this, is to try to bring people on both sides and find out where we agree and take the politics out of it.
Yeah. My mentor, Gottfried Mueller, he's died a few years ago in his 90s, but he ran programs for abused kids in Germany, and he was very pro-life. And so what he did was he opened a home for women who are pregnant. Rather than running around, you know, excoriating people, he said, hey, if you're pregnant, come here. We'll take care of you throughout your pregnancy, and we'll also help you in the first few years if you need, you know. And it seems like that's that whole life principle that you're talking about, that's a rational direction for us to go. And I want people to know that there are Democrats on both sides of this issue. And I'm guessing there probably are Republicans on both sides of the issue as well. And that there's not even two sides. There's 100 pieces to this at the very least. Kristen Day, the executive director of Democrats for Life, democratsforlife.org. Thank you for dropping by.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Good conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Stick around. Place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no, not a chance. Tom in North Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Tom, I just need a second here, so don't cut me off.
Okay.
I don't understand how pro-life and pro-choice are the opposite words of each other, because the opposite of life is not choice. The opposite of life is, we know what the opposite of life is.
Yeah.
I think that the discussion should be framed in terms of pro a woman's right to choose, which is a noun, the woman, pro the government's right to choose, because just because a woman has choice does not mean that she's going to terminate the pregnancy.
Sure.
And most women don't. And sure. I think that when you were talking about how is it that we get into a conversation with people, you know, they have different points of view. I am a pro-life person. I'm a whole life person, I guess, like that woman was saying. Mm-hmm. But I am pro a woman's right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why it is that, you know, pro a woman's right to choose means termination of a pregnancy. But in my mind, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I get so frustrated with this, because to me, if we want to have this debate, you know, like you wrote the book about words and how they matter.
Yeah.
When we talk about the debate, first off, I grew up in a Catholic, you know, dogma growing up. And, you know, the word abortion is so loaded. It's such a loaded word, and it means basically killing. You know, and
well, that's because at some stage it is killing. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge that. And the question is, at what point is that what starts out as one sperm cell and one egg cell, at what point does that become a human life? And that
I agree, but what the woman was saying that was on there with you is exactly what I think was the right thing, and it's what I told my church when I went to the Catholic Church, and the woman came with her baby bottles, and she was the so-called the pro-life person. I said, why is it that you don't have the baby bottles and filling up with money to say and have the pro-choice woman, the pro-woman's right to choose woman come in here and talk about the fact that, you know, there is a choice. It's this or it's that. And I don't understand, because to me, it's the government. We talk about, you know, the Republicans always talk about, oh, big government. This is the biggest government intrusion into a woman that there possibly can be to take away her choice. And that choice is not always to terminate the pregnancy.
Right. Right. And and that's why I said we need to have a conversation about this in the United States, an honest, open, rational conversation. And we haven't, and I don't think we're going to for some time, because as Kristen pointed out, both sides of this, but in particular, well, actually both sides, are able to fundraise off it. They're able to promote their candidates off it. They're able to simplify what is actually a very complex issue. And I think that that's a tragedy. And I love the concept of whole life.
I think that,
you know, I'm saying, you know, if somebody is going to call themselves pro-life, then okay, where's the money for the children who are in foster care all over America, many of whom are living below the poverty level, and or the kids that really should be in foster care because they're in such abusive households, but this, you know, various states don't even have the money to place them anymore.
Absolutely. And where is the money to actually be able to encourage a woman, maybe that her choice would be not to terminate the pregnancy?
Right. Yeah,
because to me, I think that we would get a lot further in this country in terms of this conversation if we change this into a woman's right to choose, the way that Bill Clinton always framed it, versus pro the government's right to choose.
Yeah, actually, the way Bill Clinton always framed it was, let's make abortions legal, safe, and rare. And that's in my opinion, that's a reasonable statement. And particularly the rare part, and because, you know, I don't think that this is an easy choice for any woman, but here it is, Tom, you and I, two guys sitting around talking about it. I, you know, for years and years, I used to say, I don't think that men should even talk. I generally don't talk about abortion because I don't have any idea what it would be like to be pregnant. I'm the father of three kids, but I, you know, I've seen it. I've been there. I delivered two of my three children or had a, you know, caught them. Louise would say she delivered them, and she's right. It's a lot of work. And I, you know, this is something that women, maybe we should have a referendum that only women are allowed to vote on, and a discussion that only women are allowed to vote on. But anyway, thank you very much for the call, Tom. I want to move along from this topic. Virginia in Portland. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Tom, I want to reframe the debt debate because the Republicans traumatize and terrorize voters with it, and it's just bogus. You don't compare your debt to your annual income or even to the nation's annual income. You compare your liabilities, your debt, to your assets.
That's correct.
And the assets of the federal government, the federal lands, the mineral rights, our fisheries, our infrastructure and improvements, our airwaves are astronomical. We don't even know what that number is.
Yes, it's in the quadrillions.
Which makes our national debt a puny home equity loan.
That's my
on
point.
A home that's worth billions, and we've taken out $10,000.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah, I'm totally with you.
We have to emphasize that over and over so people understand this is not the end of the world. It's not where we'd like to be, but I have a modest proposal for paying it off. The Fed, as I understand the last number I heard, has given to the banksters approximately the amount of money of our federal debt.
Yes.
And they've done it just by printing our money.
Yeah.
Why don't we take that debt obligation from the Fed, back to the Treasury and tell the banksters, you pay that back to us. We'll retire our debt. We won't complain about the fact that you clearly devalued our money.
Here's the problem, Virginia. The banksters have already paid it back. Those have all been in the form of short-term loans. So there's not much on that. There's only $2.5 trillion in the Fed's balance sheet right now, I believe.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word ugly, and more your calls. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very dendrophilously ugly, brought to you by Edison Factor, a supplement for the brain. The good. Bulgaria and France, both members of the European Union, have now officially banned the controversial practice known as fracking, a method used to retrieve shale gas deposits as a source of energy. Fracking has been shown to trigger earthquakes, and many argue it has incredibly adverse effects on the environment. The banning of fracking in the two nations has helped to promote a greater environmental movement across Europe, with other nations considering a ban on fracking while looking into greener and safer forms of energy. During a time when France, Bulgaria, and the rest of Europe are facing economic troubles, they are still conscious of the fact that we need to move away from dangerous and harmful forms of energy and move towards greener and safer forms of energy for the future. The bad. Ricky Santorum. At a 2008 Press and People of Faith in Politics forum, Santorum labeled the Democratic Party as the Party of Woodstock and said the Democratic lawmakers prey upon our primal lusts. He went on to say that the party is about sexual freedom. That's what it's about, homosexuality. It's about sexual freedom. No secret that Santorum is quite literally scared straight by homosexuality and has made numerous eye-raising statements about homosexuality during the 2012 campaign. Just because a party stands up for something it believes in, like equal rights for gays, doesn't mean it's all about it, or that it has a secret agenda to promote sexual freedom in America. And let's be honest, there are plenty of Republicans who are all about sexual freedom. Just ask Newt. And the very, very ugly David Koch. Koch, one half of the gruesome twosome known as the Koch brothers, was interviewed by the Palm Beach Post over the weekend. In the interview, Koch openly flaunted that he and his brother's willingness and overwhelming ability to basically purchase public opinion and even an election. When asked about his fiscal efforts to help Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker avoid recall, Koch stated, "We're helping him, as we should. We've gotten pretty good at this over the years. We spent a lot of money in Wisconsin. We're going to spend more." End of quote. I'll actually agree with Koch. They've gotten very good at pouring money into the political arena over the years and destroying the power of the people and destroying our democracy. The incredible candor with which Koch speaks about his plans to interfere with our democratic government has no place in our society and is very, very ugly. Wow, that's actually pretty astounding. Our quote for the day, by the way, I just have to share this with you. You know, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, DSK, the guy who got busted for allegedly raping the hotel maid in New York and is now back in Europe. He's been taken into custody by police as a suspect in a prostitution ring inquiry. He apparently showed up at a number of orgies where there were a lot of naked women and the guys were having sex with them, he among them. And his lawyer, in defense of Strauss-Kahn, said basically that he didn't know that these naked women that he was invited to have sex with were prostitutes. He said, and this is a verbatim quote, his lawyer from Henry Leclerc. He said, "I challenge you to distinguish a naked prostitute from any other naked woman." Maybe the fact that she's willing to have sex with Dominique Strauss-Kahn would qualify. I don't know. Bottom bump. Ah, yes. Okay. Dave in Riverview, Michigan on WDTW says you disagree with me. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, hi, how are you doing? I wanted to push back a little bit on your contention that lowering the corporate tax rate and taking out the loopholes that Obama or I guess Geithner presented is a good idea because I see it as a perpetuation of a long-term strategy of the Republicans and the corporate interests. It used to be 70, and then it went down to 35, and each time it's, okay, we'll lower it, but we'll take away the loophole.
Now, the personal rate used to be 70. I don't think the corporate rate in this country has ever been above 50, but in any case.
Well, yeah, I guess it was the personal rate, but they said take out the loopholes for the people that are paying that high marginal tax rate.
Yeah, that was so the personal tax rate. It went from 74 down to Reagan took it down to 28%. It's at 36 right now, 35 right now.
Right. So now the corporate rate is 35, and they want to take it down, and the idea is to remove the loopholes to get a higher effective tax rate.
Right.
Well, I see that as soon as the Republicans get back into power, they're going to start adding more loopholes if we take any out or successful in removing them. When the Republicans get in, they'll add more loopholes. And then some years down the line, when the Democrats finally get back in, they'll say, hey, look, okay, we'll lower the tax rate, but we got to get rid of the loopholes, and it'll drop down to whatever, 21%. And then the Republicans will get back in, and they'll add more loopholes. And years after that, the Democrats will get in and we'll say, hey, look, okay, we'll lower it again if we get rid of the loopholes.
No, but we've got to do something. There's so many loopholes right now. The General Electric submits a 19-foot-tall stack of paper, 19 feet tall. You can't hold a stack of paper that tall without it falling over. 19-foot-tall stack of paper was their Internal Revenue Receipt filing statement for 2010 or 2011.
Understood.
That's crazy. We've got to do something. If we've got to do something, let's do this. I think the problem that you're really identifying, Dave, is that these corporations will buy politicians, and those politicians will do their bidding to drill these loopholes. And wealthy people will buy politicians. And what you're really, let's take this to the larger frame here, which is money corrupting politics. And that's what we need to go after. We need to say corporations aren't people and money is not speech. And so the speech of billionaires can be limited because it's just money. It's not speech. Money is goods, not speech. And corporations are not persons. They don't have 14th Amendment rights. They don't have 5th Amendment rights. They don't have 1st Amendment rights. And we need to go in that direction. So that's where I'd go with this. Thank you, Dave, for the call. Justin in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Justin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Real quick, this is kind of a personal story about, how Republicans say contraception is a bad thing and it's not medically necessary. Well, about 9 years ago, when my wife became pregnant with our, first and only child, she developed severe medical conditions from the pregnancy, which included an irregular heartbeat, gestational diabetes, and hypertension. And so it was a very difficult pregnancy. And so, at the end of the pregnancy, she went on bed rest for like 12 weeks.
Wow.
So at about the ninth week in the bed rest in the hospital, which was a nightmare, by the way, the doctor comes in and says we've scheduled a C-section for, I think it was 2 days forward. But he also said, he goes, you can never get pregnant again.
Right.
Out of medical.
Because it might kill you.
Might kill her. Yeah. And so he said, you have four options. And the first option was no more sex, which was off the table. I can get a vasectomy, she can get a tubal ligation, or she can stay on birth control pills until she can no longer, actually have a child. So my wife decided to stay on birth control pills.
Yeah.
And fortunately, when my son was born, all those medical conditions went away, but she's been on birth control pills for 9 years because, when the doctor told us this, he said, if she gets pregnant again, her chances of dying within the first month, even when you might not even know you're pregnant, are in the 95 percentile range.
Wow.
And so she is literally, this is like a life-saving thing for
her. See, I hear that as more of an argument for, after we had our third child, we thought, okay, three is enough. And Louise had given birth to three children and been through that. And so it was like, it wasn't even a coin toss. It was my turn to have a little pain, and I went in and got a vasectomy. I think you're making a strong argument for a vasectomy here.
Well, the funny thing was I originally volunteered for it, but my wife said, she goes, with surgeries, there's risk. And I said, well, whatever, babe, but I'm not going to risk your life.
I think they've got this one nailed down a little. I do understand that vasectomy for men slightly increase your risk of heart attack. Because the body responds to I don't want to go through the whole medical thing, but in any case, Justin, thank you for the call. It's a good story you shared with us. Thank you. Jason in Hollywood. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First off, I'd like to say that I'm going to be a little bit nervous talking to you, so bear with me for a minute.
Sure.
Other than my parents, you are the most influential person in my life because I've read almost all of your books. But I do disagree with you on the on when life begins as far as abortion goes.
Well, you don't know my opinion on when life begins, so it would be hard for you to disagree.
Okay.
I haven't taken a position.
I've listened to you a lot. Now, maybe so, maybe not, but I believe life begins at conception. Mm-hmm. But I also believe that Roe v. Wade, well, actually, I know that Roe v. Wade was decided on a woman's right to privacy.
By and large,
so
yes.
So I am not against abortion 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that being said, life does begin at conception. And I think that a woman has to deal with her choice.
Isn't there a larger question, Jason? And that's not when does life begin, but when does human life begin?
You know, I'm really not sure about that, but you could actually look back at our very first ancestors, which were the stromatolites that began life on this planet to begin with, and that was life then.
Well, that was the first animal life.
Like
the first life was green algae, actually. Or red algae.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
single-celled red algae.
Far enough,
that inhaled methane and exhaled oxygen and ultimately destroyed the world by exhaling too much oxygen and making way for green algae. But
yeah,
you want to go back a billion years.
But anyway, I just want to talk about that issue a little bit. Now, like I said, I am, I guess you'd call me pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather a woman chose life. And I think that we do need to have this discussion, and I think that women need to choose life, but they also should have that choice.
Well, here again, Jason, once again, we have two men having a conversation about women's reproductive systems, and I really think that this is a debate that women should be having with each other, not with you or me. But thank you for your call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Indeed. Back with more of your thoughts on this. Oh, the Republican Party claims to represent religious America. Guess what the Catholic Church just came out with? I'll tell you right after the break.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Okay, so here's what the Catholic Church just came out with. Well, it was not yesterday, but it's actually been stated a number of times, but it was restated more recently. The Pope recently declared that health care was an inalienable right. An inalienable right. So why are the people who are fighting so hard on the issue of whether or not a religious employer should or shouldn't offer contraception services, why aren't they equally fighting for everybody in America to have health care? You know, this is the thing that gets me is, in many ways, abortion is almost a distraction from these larger issues. Because as Kristen pointed out in the Democrats for Life, you know, there's this whole life concept. You know, are you in favor of life throughout life? And that means having a national health care system. That means, you know, going back to Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights, that you have the right to a job. You have the right to housing. You have the right to health care. These are basic rights. And if you can't get those things in the marketplace because it's failing, as in Great Depression times, or if you can't get those things in the marketplace because you were born with an injury or a birth defect of some sort or some sort of problem, or if you can't get those things because you were born in a part of the country that is so broke and busted that they're just not available, then the government should be the provider of last resort. And I would say in the case of health care that the government should be the provider of first resort. And the same thing with education. What happened to whole life? What happened to taking care of people through their whole entire lives? And if you're going to quote religious people, okay, a broad coalition of religious groups in America filed a friend of the brief court. You know, the Supreme Court is debating Obamacare, right? They're having hearings on Obamacare. And a group which included Methodists, Presbyterians, Catholics, and a whole bunch in between filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief with the Supreme Court on behalf of Obamacare, saying, we need to be providing health care to everybody in America. That's what religious people do. It's like, duh. Anyway, Tom in San Rafael. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I had an idea for it's a populist idea, I think, for lowering gas prices.
Yeah.
And I think one thing it's going to do is it's going to separate the fiscal and religious conservatives.
Yeah.
It'll improve manufacturing in the United States and a couple other things. And this is an idea. I think that we should make it illegal to transport or sell oil products that are either pumped or refined in the United States outside the United States in any week where the previous week's retail price of gasoline is more than 250 pennies a gallon.
Why even do that? Why not just make it illegal to export petroleum products or any fossil fuels from the United States? We're shipping enormous amounts of coal over to Asia. I mean, we're just, you know, ship after ship after ship of coal is going over to Asia that is being mined here in the United States. We are importing oil. We are also importing cheap gasoline, and we are exporting slightly more expensive gasoline. We've got a huge trade in fossil fuels running through the United States, and I'm with you. Let's just put a stop to all of it and say that's it. If it's a fossil fuel that came from the United States, it has to be used in the United States. And by the way, we're going to start replacing all those things with solar and wind and everything else. And let's have some rational policies here. Rodney in Chicago Heights, Illinois. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
Tom, how you doing? Hey, you know, that guy that was on either yesterday or the day before talking about nationalizing our natural resources, you know, that's a very good idea, you know, provide everybody with an income. But it occurred to me when you was talking about they were going to use the money for the housing settlement to tear down vacant homes. Why don't we nationalize the foreclosed homes as, like they do in drug cases, you know, as part of a criminal conspiracy and actually put people in those houses and, you know, and use a portion of what would be, you know, a guaranteed income to fund Medicare Part E, so everybody has health care.
Medicare for everybody. That's a great idea, Rodney. It's a great idea. Thank you very much for sharing it with us. A fine idea. Rick in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, I've been watching Santorum, and I know he's whiter than and cleaner than fresh snow, but I'm a Pennsylvanian that hasn't forgotten about what he did while he was living in Virginia, and he sent his children to a charter school in Pennsylvania, and then he it added up to $100,000.
Wow.
In bills.
I thought he homeschooled his kids. Was that just part of the time?
Me? Pardon me?
Didn't he homeschool his kids, or was that just part of the time and part of the time they went to charter school?
Well, he did send them to charter school up here in Pennsylvania while I lived in Virginia.
And that charter school was paid for with state funds to the tune of $100,000.
It was paid for until he got caught.
Oh.
And then the school district, Penn Hills, was trying to make him pay for it, but he ended up not paying for it. The state of Pennsylvania, which I am... citizen of, we ended up settling with Penn Hills and gave them $55,000. So if you figure it out, he screwed us out of $100,000, and then the state $55,000 on that, and the school district lost $45,000.
Right.
So a total of $200,000 is what he took out of the people of Pennsylvania.
So Rick, if I'm getting this right, the carry home message from your call is, as a resident of Pennsylvania who knows Rick Santorum, he's not Mr. Squeaky Clean, and you're not a big fan of his. And most,
no.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm one Pennsylvania that hasn't forgot what he did.
There you go. There's a reason why he lost by, what did he lose by, 14 points or something like that when he was running for the Senate? I mean, he just got whomped. He got his butt kicked right across the room. Rick, thanks a lot for the call from Pennsylvania. Oh, my. I mean, it's great. Coming up tomorrow, the war on labor, the war on women, anybody but Mitt is the Republican Party dying. Steve Malzberg is going to drop by and tell us that, no, everything's fine with the Republican. Oh, really? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.